So far in Saluting the Stars of DB, we've paid homage to Ren Miller and Charlie Board, Dick Cranbourne and John Stewart, John Eden, Jeff McComas, Sir Eric Pierce, Ron Casey, Lou Richards and Bill Collins. But there's been one serious omission.
This is Monty Blanford calling rheumatism sufferers. Why let the nagging, depressing pain of rheumatism get you down? Get quick relief for 1 and 6 at your chemist or store with Rue Pills. Rue Pills kill pain. R-H-U, Rue Pills gently remove poisonous waste matter. For rheumatism, backache, neuritis, joint pains, get Rue Pills today.
That was the voice of Francis Victory Blanford, known to 3DB listeners for more than 2 decades as Monty Blanford. Monty did most of the general announcing shifts that an announcer could do at DB, but he'll always be remembered particularly for his Philosopher's Scrapbook, a program in which he read pieces of prose, poetry and philosophy by famous and not so famous authors. His program was so popular that books were published containing his personally selected pieces. And they were bestsellers for their time, not only in Melbourne, where he was a household name, but interstate, where the books sold solely on their content, with no help from the fame of the author. Anyone who has a copy of Monty Blanford's Philosopher's Scrapbook in their library has a collector's item, on which it's very hard to put a price. From an historical radio point of view, they're almost priceless. Monty the man, like John Stewart, was a real character. As with John, he was a one-off. There was no one quite like Monty Blanford, or if there was, he certainly didn't work on radio. On air, Monty reminisced, read commercials, sometimes dithered as only he could. But all the while, he had that touch of magic that makes for out-of-the-ordinary radio. He had the gift of communication. Off air, he was just as individual. His studio manager and fellow announcer, Maurie Callard, remembers Monty.
Well, I can tell you about Monty and this, his philosopher's scrapbook and all that sort of thing with Monty. He was an irascible, delightful, aggravating person. If you like, he'd advise wonderfully well. He'd compile stuff beautifully. He'd present things well for 6 weeks. And then the 7th week, well, it was quite a different nature. I liked Monty. I liked his work.
And so did 75% of Melbourne radio listeners who chose to listen to their Monty. There are many stories about him. Here's John Eden with one of the most delightful.
The 8:45 bulletin on Sunday morning was very important. Everybody listened to DB News. And at that stage, we're working over in the old studios in Flinders Street. And the staff lockers were in the same studio area. And we had a fellow by the name of Monty Blanford, who's gone to heaven, God rest him. But Monty had a dreadful case of emphysema, and also he was a bad asthmatic. And it also was half blind. I think he was blind in one eye. In fact, I think he had a glass eye. And he was also pretty deaf. Bath and all that, rather nice sort of bloke. But he'd come up when you were working into the studio, and these metal lockers, you know, he'd put his coat and hat and stuff in there, and bang, it'd go, you know, while you were working. And it was all pretty tense, you know, you were working for 3DB and you didn't want to make any mistakes. And then you'd have your news in front of you, and we had what we used to call the Bible, in other words, a working schedule, an operation schedule, and he'd come over and take this from underneath you while you were reading the news. Pardon me, and that leads to another point, that cough. And this is what happened to Danny. There were 2 buttons alongside the microphone. One was to cut off the microphone so you could cough, if you felt the need to do that. And the other one was communication with the engineers down below. Well, Danny's having his ordeal reading the news, you see, and all the clatters going on from Monty and all the rest, and the coughing and the spluttering and then the coming over and taking of the schedule from underneath his news. Danny reaches out, and obviously he's going to pull the wrong button, isn't he, you see? So he pulls the wrong button and says, excuse me, Lord, but it's necessary. He said, for Christ's sake, Mont, would you please be quiet? And over the air it went. Anyway, that's right, he continued with the news. And very few protests, actually. But the next morning he got a note from Sir Jack Williams. Now, Jack Williams was the That stage, big boss of the Herald. Delightful man. I loved his personalities around him. But he could be rather nasty on occasion. But anyway, the note came into Danny. Danny, I appreciate your remark. I enjoyed it very much. Is that the sort of thing you should say when people are going to church?
It may sound trite, but it's true. To many people, their way of going to church was through Monty's philosopher's scrapbook.
The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Now, does that sound like the sort of man who'd clatter around the studio and annoy his fellow announcers? I had the pleasure of meeting Monty only once. I was a very young lad, about 13, I guess. I had a friend who was a turntable operator here at DB, and with Monty's permission, he invited me in to see them at work. I was enthralled at my tender age to see my friend spinning in the huge transcription records which contained the popular serials of the day, the multi-track records providing the commercial breaks, and Monty himself, sitting at the announcer's console, scripts everywhere, aiming a gong stick for chimes inaccurately almost every time. But through all of this, using that microphone as a dear friend. While his monument is Philosopher's Scrapbook, Monty has another claim to fame. It's not generally known that Monty compared the first hit parade on Melbourne radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once more, the Hit Parade of Victoria is on the air, brought to you by Independent Theatres. The Johnson Story is at Kinema Albert Park and Village Tourette. It will be at National Richmond tomorrow, then It Happened One Night. The Guilt of Janet Ames is at Astor St Kilda, whilst the Maltese Falcon will be at Burnley Theatre tomorrow, and then Footsteps in the Dark. Whilst the latter picture, Footsteps in the Dark, is at Adelphi North Carlton tomorrow, and then the Maltese Falcon. Plaza Chelsea screens The Bishop's Wife until Tuesday, then This Man is Mine. And in the city, My Brother Jonathan is at the Grosvenor. Well, now for the hits. Hit number 8 this week is I'm Looking Over a Four-Leaf Clover. Tonight it's played by Russ Morgan and his orchestra, with vocal by the Ames Brothers and Ensemble.
The Hit Parade on Sunday night at 6:30 was a runaway success, but a less likely DJ than Monty Blandford you'd be hard-pressed to find. Actually, DB's first DJ was in the late 50s. It was Jeff Cork, who went on to become the first man seen on Melbourne television and the near-immortal Corky King of the Kids. But when he was a kid, before he became a DJ, he started in a much humbler position at DB. What were his feelings?
Terror. Well, it was an institution, and still is, and I'm sure will be for years. However, it was complete terror because I went as an office boy and I was getting sandwiches from Eric Pierce and Maurie Callard, and that was, you know, very, very exciting, wasn't it?
Exciting enough for Jeff to persevere and progress to breakfast turntable operator and a chance to get on the air.
And we used to start at 6 o'clock and start testing at 1:45, you know, playing a few discs to check out the balance and all that thing. And you'd always hope that the announcer wasn't there because that would give you a chance to have a bit of a chat and say, this is 3DB Melbourne, or 3DB Melbourne, 3LK Central Victoria, testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, and that was very exciting. And
You'd play a record or half of a record and then get back on, and as soon as the announcer walked in, you'd be furious, and you always hoped he'd be late. And that happened occasionally, and you'd be on the air for 10 minutes by yourself, and that was very, very exciting.
Not nearly as exciting as the times ahead, when eventually Corky was given his real break. And each night, the young Geoffrey Cuthbert Cork broke tradition at DB and went from, as I mentioned before, being an announcer to one of those newfangled DJs. And this is the theme that introduced him. Corky's program was a collection of the best and most modern music around. Always melodic, always chosen by Jeff with his impeccable taste in music. But the other fascination for his listeners was that in this exciting era of the 50s, when the big stars were coming to Australia, Corky was not only meeting them, but actually rubbing shoulders with them.
After one of the shows with Nat King Cole, who of course was a great pianist, as well as being such a beautiful singer, at the Savoy Plaza, where they stayed in those days. And we were, they had a table set up for them to, those people to come back after midnight. And there were about 12 of us at the table. And that was all. And the dining room was empty. And we had a meal and, or a snack or a couple of drinks and sitting around having a chat. And he disappeared. And all of a sudden we heard a piano tinkling in the background and wondered, what is doing that? And it happened to be Nat Cole, who was just walking back from the toilet, or I've got no idea where he'd been, and sat down and started picking out songs at around about one, and he tinkled away at the piano until about five. And that experience was just wonderful, because we eventually strolled down and sat around and listened. He didn't play anything. He'd play half a tune and then wander on to the next and ask for another Jack Daniels, and produced a bottle, and he'd sit there and just... He was just a great man.
From Nat King Cole to another legendary star.
Louis Armstrong came out here for Lee Gordon too, but Melbourne was his first city on an Australian-wide tour. And he, or the Lee Gordon organisation, decided that they'd like to have some 30-minute interviews to send to the other stations in the other states, and they asked me to do them, and that was quite, you know, exciting and pleasant. And he was only here in Melbourne for 3 days, and then he had to a couple of days off, and then went to Sydney and whatever it was, and I virtually spent 3 days with him, and I think that was the first bit of graft I ever got. They paid me £10 for 3 days' work. Well, that was quite exciting. You know, £10 was a hell of a lot, wasn't it? And spending 3 days with Louis Armstrong was quite incredible. And plus his entourage and his wife, Lucille. And he had Dr. Pugh, his private physician, his private valet. And he was a very fascinating man. And he'd sit, and I'd be sitting around in his suite. They stayed at Chevron in those days. And say, "All right, man, you can come out now and we'll do another take." So you'd stroll out, you'd do 10, 15 minutes, or whatever it had to be. "That's enough." And he'd go and have a shower and order a meal. This could be at 2 and 3 in the morning. He lived a very funny sort of lifestyle.
And speaking of lifestyles, Jeff even got to interview Frank Sinatra. And there's a story there, too.
Sinatra came out with a lady called Anne McCormick, who was a fine singer. And it was the time that he'd attacked journalists and reporters and those sort of people at the entrance to the stadium, because he was a little bit cross, I think, with publicity that he'd received. And he, this gentleman, who was quite a popular radio interviewer, not with Mr. Sinatra, I commend you. You had to call him that too, Mr. Sinatra, all the time. And he started off his interview, and I was the next cab off the rank. I was standing in the queue. And he said, "It's nice to interview a man who came out with Anne McCormick to star in the big show, Frank Sinatra." Well, of course, that quite annoyed Frank. And you, having interviewed thousands of people, would know how difficult it is when you get a yes and no answer. And that's what he gave this fella. He said, you know, is it nice to be in Australia? Yes. Well, normally when you're chatting with a person, you're thinking of the next question, aren't you? And if you're just getting yeses and nos, you get a nothing interview. And that's what he got. And I thought, oh, dear me, I was a nervous wreck. And I went and turned on the little recorder after this guy left. And said, it's so nice to be with you, Mr. Sinatra, and thank you for having me. And I enjoyed your show last night, and it was great. And you had to butter up to him a little bit. And if you didn't, you'd be off your brain, because they had about five or six of the biggest men I've ever seen in my life standing around. I don't know whether they carried his bags or his toothbrush, but they were pretty big. And he let go and gave me a fantastic interview. And it was so good that it was later played in the States, and all, because he got right down to earth about lots and lots of things.
Little would Corky know when interviewing Frank Sinatra that in not too many years to come, in Melbourne, his face would be as well known as Mr. Sinatra's, and his fame at a local level would equal the same said gentleman. Jeff played the strains of Deep Purple for the last time in mid-1956 when he journeyed from Flinders Street to Bendigo Street in Richmond and began his career in the new medium of television. But his radio times were lovely while they lasted.